Thank you. It's an honor to be here, and I would like to thank Lenore for the invitation. She asked me to speak about why American conservatives have been attracted to Strauss and Voegelin. And I said, I would under one condition, can I let the conservatives know what Strauss and Voegelin thought about them? And she said, yes. So here we are. For more than 50 years, American conservatives have treated Strauss and Voegelin as fellow travelers of a sort. At the same time, the relationship has never been perfect. Fruitful, yes, but not perfect. There are significant ways in which political philosophy stands apart from conservatism, and I would argue that that's appropriate, and I'll try to elaborate in the end of my remarks why that should be so. So here are some questions. What was it we saw in Voegelin and Strauss that made them seem attractive? Where, on the other hand, are the points of discontinuity? And going forward, what should we make of this? I think a number of things attracted us to reasonable things, to Eric Voegelin. Conservatives loved his combination of erudition and righteous indignation, the scholar and the warrior. Of course, we all remember his arcane but powerful, "Don't let them immunitize the eschaton," rah. And that's actually the bumper sticker version. But really, listen to the man's thumotic prose. "The putrefaction of Western civilization, as it were, has released a cadaveric poison, spreading its infection through the body of humanity. What no religious leader, no philosopher, no imperial conqueror of the past has achieved, to create a man, to create a community of mankind by creating a common concern for all men, has now been realized through the community of suffering under the earthwide expansion of Western foulness." This was a thinker who did not pull his punches. He referred to modern universities as brothels of opinion. He referred to modern intellectuals as pimps. And I'm told that when he returned to Germany after the war to offer a course on Hitler and the Germans at Munich, he used to walk down the street greeting the Germans who never left as follows: "Und guten Tag, was haben wir hier? Schwein." Secondly, I think conservatives loved Voegelin's ability to use the wisdom of the past as a tool for analyzing the pathologies of modernity. He showed us that modern ideologies are at root so many attempts to flee the human condition, a condition that the ancient philosophers and early Christian writers had articulated supremely well. Voegelin was thus literally a conservative in the sense of conserving the wisdom of the ages. I think finally that for religious conservatives, Voegelin seemed especially attractive because of his hallmark emphasis on transcendence. Indeed, all of Voegelin's philosophy is informed by his belief that a proper orientation to the divine is indispensable to the health of the soul and the polity. He thus came off as a theological critic of modernity, of modern atheism, materialism, and nihilism. So far, so good. But many religious conservatives became disenchanted with Voegelin over time. He described himself as a mystic, not a Catholic or an Orthodox of any stripe. And for Calvinists and Roman Catholics alike, there was an aspect of his philosophy that could not have set well, which is that he took an extremely dim view of doctrine. For him, the divine human experience is what mattered, and that was fundamentally an experience, not a set of propositions or doctrines. Voegelin thus could not satisfy folks who wanted him to avow a particular Christology, a particular ecclesiology, or even, frankly, a theology in any doctrinal sense. This is the first point of discontinuity between Voegelin and some conservatives. As a related matter, Voegelin was basically dismissive of natural law. Recourse to nature just isn't enough, he thought. We cannot do without divine experience as an ordering phenomenon. Another point of discontinuity relates to his critique of 20th century ideology. True, he fulminated against fascism, communism, Nazism, progressivism, etc. The problem is that he regarded classical liberalism and American conservatism as ideologies. This comes out most clearly in his correspondence. He was known to go ballistic if invited to an American conservative function or to contribute something to a conservative cause. A nasty letter to Peter Berger, the sociologist, could be produced as Exhibit A. I stumbled on it while reading correspondence. Berger wanted him to speak on a conservative panel. Voegelin wrote back, "You obviously have not read my work." A chilly letter to our own George Nash also makes the point. Voegelin writes, "Just because I am not stupid enough to be a liberal does not mean I am stupid enough to be a conservative." That should give us pause. Far from siding with American conservatism, Voegelin thought that some kind of combination of classical economics with a social welfare state was an optimal way of, quote, "drawing upon the resources of Christianity and ratio," close quote. Finally, like so many thoughtful Europeans of his age, Voegelin found America's reverence for the Constitution quite baffling and ideological. Constitution worship, a la Justice Hugo Black, was simply unintelligible to him. The reason for this, if we really wanted to get it, it would require a small disquisition on the history of the battles over the written Constitution in France and Germany during the 19th century, and I won't go there. But here's the point. Insofar as American conservatives want to look to the Constitution as a saving document for contemporary politics, we will not find much support in Eric Voegelin. His view was this, quote, I'm tempted to do it with a German accent, but I'm going to resist. "A constitutional model that is so manifestly historically contingent must lead unavoidably to difficulties and cause severe damage when it is dogmatized into a worldview and its elements are raised to articles of faith." Leo Strauss. Why have conservatives been so attracted to Leo Strauss? Perhaps one reason is that the enemy of my enemy is my friend. Strauss challenged relativists, historicists, nihilists, progressivists in a fresh and penetrating way. All these movements amount to the claim that there is no permanent truth or truths. Strauss thought they had not proved their case. This was the opening for his epic search for permanent truth by retracing the idea of natural right through ancient and modern thinkers. Another commonality is that Strauss was a champion of the idea that ideas have consequences. His works don't traffic in economic determinism or Freudian psychobabble about subconscious forces beyond our control. His assumption is that the greatest philosophers determine the character of human life and human relations. I'll never forget my own first experience reading Strauss as a college senior. I suddenly felt as if all the faddish ideas I and my friends were worked up over were actually something none of us knew they were. Vestiges of great thinkers exploring the fundamental alternative answers to the permanent human questions. Mine turned out to be a hodgepodge of ideas, a little bit of Locke and Rousseau and Nietzsche and Plato indiscriminately mixed together. But it was thrilling, almost intoxicating, for a young man, a young mind, to sense a genealogy of ideas. I will not dwell on the sense of superiority that can yield. That was not my attraction, per se, but I do see it often. Anyway, if the proclivity to take ideas seriously was a point of common ground between Strauss and conservatives, another was the narrative that Strauss wanted to tell, one of epic civilizational decline, dating roughly from the birth of modernity in the 15-teens. The dates and the shape of Strauss's narrative would have sat well with many conservatives inclined to view the Reformation as the first step in a long saga of secularization and modernization that destroyed the cultural unity of the West. The specifics of Strauss's story, which emphasizes Machiavelli rather than Luther as the father of modernity, differ from the typical Catholic narrative, but the arc is similar, as well as the ultimate consequence, which is that we have reached a crisis of modernity and now need to retrace our steps back to older times in order to recover some sense of where we went wrong. As an aside, I should say that this return to the ancients should have virtually no appeal to classical economic liberals. And perhaps this is a good point to turn to discontinuities between Strauss and conservatives. I can't think of a single passage in all of Strauss where he shows any respect for classical economic principles. I'm just looking to see if anybody wants to refute that, but I think that's right. Nor does he have high regard for the material motivations that drive economic activity in general. If anything, he would say that modern economics is inconceivable without the unleashing of acquisitiveness that begins with Machiavelli, and he thought that this was the beginning of a slippery slope towards nihilism. The economics of Locke and Smith was thus a passing moment within a broader process of decline. Again, why should this appeal to economic conservatives? At the same time, I wonder why traditional conservatives find Strauss appealing at the end of the day. The difficulty is that Strauss has no serious respect for tradition. While searching for the ground of moral authority in natural right, Strauss made clear that he rejected convention, or the ancestral, or the traditional, or the accumulated wisdom of the ages as a viable ground. He was a critic of Burke, not of everything in Burke, but certainly of this, that Burke supposed our historical way of life would offer guidance for our future. But for Strauss, nature, not history, was the only rational guide. This also separates Strauss from those conservatives, our front porch folks, if we're going to do a classification, they haven't been mentioned yet. These folks who cherish locality and community and shared experiences and communal narratives. For Strauss, genuine philosophy would inevitably alienate the thinker from his community. That is because the search for truth, as Strauss understood it, was a search for an abstract, universal truth, not something that resides in this or that community. Strauss was a committed rationalist, albeit it wasn't to modern rationalism that he was drawn, but to ancient. And this meant that the philosopher, having escaped the cave of conventionality, could live only ironically with those average human beings who find value in communal norms. This brings me to my last point about Strauss. I'm not sure why religious conservatives should have anything much to do with him either. This is because by taking nature as his guide, Strauss implicitly rejected revelation or biblical teaching as authoritative. It's true that he famously left his readers with a stark choice and did not stoop to solve it for them. Either the life of autonomous reason or the life of obedient love of God. There is nothing in between. And one may have the impression that he kept both possibilities open for himself, but even the slightest familiarity with what he's doing in a work like Natural Right and History will show that Strauss was engaged in a philosophical search for natural right. A corollary, I'm not going to read this paragraph, I'm just going to say it. A corollary is that he didn't have much patience for natural law either. But for Strauss, he thought it was too theological, whereas Vogelin thought it was too natural. So whatever the reasons why conservatives were attracted to Strauss, there are reasons for distance too. Indeed, if religious conservatives and front porch conservatives and traditional conservatives and economic conservatives all find Strauss attacking their commitments, then what kind of conservatives ought to like Strauss? Well, I suppose those who, like Strauss himself, are not religious, who think modern philosophy has led to a crisis of modern political life, and who hope to glean from the ancients some insights into human excellence, both individual and collective. And in fact, there are plenty of conservatives like that, and some may even be in this room. Let me close with a reflection on the relationship between political philosophy and conservatism. I've been proceeding as if it's reasonable to judge philosophers by their conservative appeal. Is it? I suppose it would be reasonable if conservatism and political philosophy were engaged in a similar set of problems. Are they? I take the criterion of a good political philosopher to be the power of illumination. Does this illuminate what was previously obscure? Political philosophy is a quest for clarity about things, political things. Conservatism, by contrast, occupies a more or less defensive posture. It always has, especially in Europe, but also in America since the dawn of the progressive era. Conservatives have something to fight for, and they are endeavoring to save it. Now, I know there's another kind of conservative who, rather than fighting for something, will be found enjoying it. I think Kirk was a conservative like this when he was engaged in history and literature in his study at Macosta. I also think Oakeshott was a conservative like this. But these kind of conservatives are rare insofar as they are not quite the movement men that drive conservatism as a whole. So conservatives are people who defend traditional goods because they know they're worth defending. Political philosophy, though, is animated by concerns altogether different from that of political battles or external goods. It is fundamentally a quest for insight, not influence. I'm not saying there's no overlap between political philosophy and conservatism. Obviously, there is. But the essential divergence between political philosophy and conservatism is not often enough stressed among conservatives. The test of a good political philosopher is not his conservative credentials, but his power to illuminate something that was previously puzzling. Do Eric Voegelin and Leo Strauss pass this test? The answer is overwhelmingly yes. Voegelin threw light on the motivations and structures of ideological mass movements. They are at root forms of psycho-spiritual rebellion. There's no one who taught us this more forcefully than Voegelin. Strauss, too, is justly celebrated for throwing light on something fundamental about political life, the friction that can arise between excellent, superior human beings and their political community. We are all too prone to downplay or ignore this problem of political life, yet it matters, because as Tocqueville and Mill both saw, as communities become more democratic, excellence becomes more suspect. Indeed, it gets mocked and scorned. This poses severe obstacles to human fulfillment properly understood. I would say something about Strauss's insights into esoteric writing deriving from that. I'll skip it. Voegelin and Strauss were so full of insight that I would not want to attempt political philosophy today without having them in my toolbox. So whether or not they made good conservatives, I think we owe it to them to evaluate them on their own terms. And for the future, I think conservatives should recognize and defend this boundary line between conservatism and political philosophy. Rather than judging our philosophers in terms of their conservative appeal, we might just celebrate political philosophy as such. Here's why. When all the conservative battles have been fought and won, I know that's not going to happen, but let's just imagine for a second. What activities might we wish to take up in our sudden expanse of free time? Certainly those activities that make life most worth living. Here, I think we shall find Russell Kirk reading Eliot in his study at Macosta. We'll find Michael Oakeshott conversing with well-educated friends. And we'll see political philosophers in general asking their questions about the nature and meaning of political life. Political philosophy is one of the things that count, because whatever else we humans are, we are creatures who, as Aristotle said, desire to understand. And thus the activity of political philosophy as an end in itself is certainly something worth conserving. Thank you.